You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. This episode, the Edit Doctor is in.
Curiously, Maggie, where are you at?
I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Woohoo! Okay. Our fair city. I'm from Greenwich, Connecticut. Well, I'm not from Greenwich, Connecticut, but I currently reside in Greenwich, Connecticut.
Okay.
So about 20 miles out of New York. And up until recently, I commuted every day. So for the last 7 years. And now I've got a new gig and I don't have to commute, which is lovely because that's $500 I don't have to spend per month doing so.
I assume from Two Guys Drinking that you're in Pasadena?
No. I'm actually in Burbank. It's still a valley, but you know that place that we shot at is actually, it's gone.
Oh, really?
Really?
It was a really interesting place. We got it because the upstairs was so, the guy that scouted it and he gave it to us, it was way too pretty. And I went there and I went, yeah, this is wrong. Like, I want it to look like a 16mm film student set.
Right.
And he goes, well, we got this lounge downstairs. And I went downstairs and said, this is perfect. And he goes, it's not very nice. Like, that's perfect. I don't want it to. I mean, upstairs, it was like you were at the Ark or something. It was incredible. And I just,
it was like you were at a bar in Hollywood.
Yeah, it was way too nice.
It's always the problem, you know, you wind up getting good things and you don't expect good things. So you sort of write around.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever heard anyone say, this location's too nice.
I know, exactly. The guy was so proud. I mean, I even think he went through and he cleaned the bottles for us and everything to look nice. I want the dingy ones with the, you know, I have no idea what those stains are on the chair kind of thing. That's what I wanted.
It's like, and you want to put the name of my bar at the end. Right. Good idea.
Yes, yeah. It's not like we were bringing in the tourists or anything, so I don't think that mattered so much.
Right. You could always put the dinge and grime in post, really.
Well, that was part of the idea. Was I wanted it to look like it was a 16mm film school. Like,
sure.
We built the set and all that stuff. So anything that decorative, I didn't want it. That was all done in 2 hours.
The whole,
really?
Everything?
And people would usually say 2 hours per one. And I went, no, 2 hours. And the last 7 minutes were the white room stuff. And
holy
we were
crap.
Running out of time for that. And that really was a set of blankets for 99 cents at Target that we just threw up against the back wall. And the lighting wasn't quite what I wanted. And then you had to do a little bit of roto to fix it. That was 7 minutes. And Kevin had an appointment that he had to go to. And he was really, when he was looking at his watch to see what time it was, I kept saying, keep looking at your watch. We're going to shoot that. It's actually in the thing. And he really just said his last lines and hauled out of there.
So it's like,
that's amazing.
19, is it 19 episodes? 20 episodes?
We did 20, there's 22, 23 that were really kind of shot for that bit. And one of them we had to throw away right away because somebody didn't make it. At one point, there was a talk of the girl who plays Starbuck on Battlestar Galactica. One of her friends had said that she liked it and wanted to know if she could do it. I'm like, well, I don't know if you know this, but we shot them all in one day. And I went, don't tell her that. Yeah. We're still shooting. Yeah. Bring her in. I said the whole idea we were going to do is I said, we're just going to get one of those fold-out card tables. And we're going to say, this is auditions for Two Guys Drinking at a Bar. For Kevin Farley's part. We're just going to put other people in there, including her, and she can just try to imitate him and realize, you know, do it very badly.
Awesome. Oh, that would have been brilliant.
Yeah, she was on Tiki Bar TV and something else. Yeah, she's like, she's just a nerd.
Yeah, that's awesome. She gets around. Very cool. Wait, that sounded
awesome.
Wrong.
I know. I was going to say.
Katie Sackhoff gets around.
I saw Tricia Helfer. I went to the Tribeca for this film we worked on in 2010. I didn't actually think it was her, and I walked into the bookstore, and I was going to walk up and go, wow, man, you look just like Tricia Helfer from Battlestar Galactica. And she turned around and I went, wait, you are Tricia Helfer, right? And she goes, yeah. And I went, man, I didn't plan on that. I got nothing. And she goes, oh, well, you can come back and try it again later. So I went back and I sat down. And I went, man, I just made a complete ass of myself. And she was circling around on the phone. I think she was pretending to be on the phone so I wouldn't come up and talk to her anymore. And when we got on the plane, of course, she's the very first seat in the first class. We're moving our way back. And the guy sitting next to her, a movie I worked on was this Billy Joel film called Last Play at Shea. And Billy Joel's manager is sitting next to her. So we walk in. He goes, dude, you rocked it out of the park. Oh, that was incredible. And then she started looking at him going, what did he do? And then she became very curious. And I went to the back of the plane and started calling up going, call Billy's manager and tell her this, like trying to get this whole conversation going. We were nowhere near each other.
You're a very awesome or desperate man, Mike. I don't know
what. Yeah, no, I don't know what to call that. That's just pathetic.
It was a good plan.
It was a good plan, except for when I didn't plan on it being her.
you know, when things are actually handed to you, you don't know what to do with them. No one ever does.
I'm ready to hold on. Let me try it again. When this is over with, I'm going to have you guys call me back so we can try it again.
Who are we talking to anyway?
That's a really good question.
Who is this guy?
Oh, God. So we've been drinking heavily with Mike J. Nichols.
When I moved here, Don LaFontaine, who has passed away since, but he was the big, you know, that does the... And I was at a thing where he was at, and I took a recorder, and I said, I think I'm just going to sit and talk to him and record it and try to get him to say a word so I can go back and edit him into this week on this and try to put it and do that. You know, sadly, he is gone now, but the voice, that's awesome.
That was a brilliant idea.
Wow.
I did try to do it with Alec Baldwin was the voiceover for the Billy Joel film, too. And when it was over with, I was like, here are some words that I'd like you to say. And basically, if you would have looked at it, you would have started laughing because it basically says, this week on Two Guys Drinking at a Bar. But not as one sentence. It was all in other words. Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant. So you had like 6 or 7 sentences, but it had all the appropriate words in there.
That's right.
And how long did it take you to splice them all together?
I did. We ran out of time. And so I just like, that's going to be the thing that goes because, you know, that's the least important of this event.
Right. But it is possibly the thing with the largest comedic impact.
I know.
Especially if it sounds like it's really chopped up.
Although now I think about it, and I certainly have him using profanity many times when he flub up a word. And I would love to go back through like 30 Rock and just Liz Lemon walks into the room. Fuck! You know, it'd be like, whoa, where did that come from? Are you guys TV watchers?
Occasionally. Yeah. I've been known to watch a little bit of television now and again.
Walking Dead, you watch
yes.
that?
Oh, yes. Oh, so my ex-girlfriend's father is Jeff Damon.
Really?
Yes.
So with being an ex, there's really no connection anymore at this point, or?
No, well, we're kind of friends, although we haven't seen her. She moved away, and I haven't seen her in ages. But yeah, there's still an amicability there.
Spoiler nice. Alert, Dale's dead. Get over it.
Everything's it's going to shit on that show with casting anyway.
Everybody dies. And then comes back.
Well, briefly.
Yeah, for a time anyway.
If you remember the show Lost, and there was a character named Boone, and I always felt sorry for this guy because he was on the show, and I guess he decided to buy a house in Hawaii, and he was going to move there, and once he does all that stuff, they kill his character off.
I know. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, that's so sad because I guess he wouldn't know.
Well, not only would he not know he was going to die, but didn't he in fact die before he died anyway? I mean, wasn't that the entire point of the entire show?
If you're looking at it in the global sense and knowing the ending or actually understanding the ending, then yes.
No one understands the ending.
Everybody dies.
Actually, the ending is the part that I always thought, I guess I kind of understand it. What I don't understand is 3.5 years in between that.
That's the part I'm iffy about.
The ending was actually fairly well wrapped up. It was pretty straightforward. It was everything else that was complete crazy town.
No, I did not once see Rod Serling walk in, so it wasn't complete.
Oh, that is true. But then again, he's also dead.
Well, I mean, they were too.
I was going to say, it would have been apropos.
I don't know. I just thought it was a bit of a, okay, Supernatural, all done. Good night. Did you watch Deadwood?
I've never seen Deadwood.
I just started watching it, and there's Garrett Dillahunt. He plays like 3 characters in it, and he's like always getting killed, too. So, but if you haven't seen it, that's not funny anymore.
Yeah, about four years ago, a friend of mine, Matt, let me borrow it, and he kept saying, you have to see it, and then he's gone on since and gotten married, and I have the box set just sitting around here, and I know he wants it back. I never see the guy.
You should watch it. It's great.
So I figure I should watch it just out of that. And I know one day I tried to put him on my iPhone to do a collection of movies or TV shows that are good to watch at the gym, and that's not one of them.
No, it's just not. No, definitely not. That requires a lot of concentration, a lot of being there. I used to work at a company called Behavior in Manhattan, and we wound up doing the Deadwood companion website. And so we wound up seeing a lot of the episodes prior to their airtime, which was a lot of fun because a lot of the post effects were not in place. So there were like crazy green screens like in the background everywhere. Yeah, I got completely hooked on that show.
That's another reason to watch it on either at least on your iPad because it's very visually interesting.
I mean, I know it's on the list. I just haven't done it yet.
But wait,
it's a huge investment to do as well. It's certainly, you know, it's got big story arcs and everything like that. You know, in for a penny, in for a pound. You can't just say watch a couple of episodes and then wait a few more weeks and then watch an episode here or there.
That's what I found about Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad was something I didn't have the time to watch. And when I watched the first episode, people were so good. And I said, I'm going to have to stop because I can see this is a commitment to, you know, keep rolling through these. And I didn't want to do it like that.
Yeah, I have a couple of those in my box set when I'm retired.
The box set bucket list?
Yeah.
I like that.
So what would be on your box set bucket list?
Well, you know what? I was going to say I would actually watch the Sherlock series again.
Oh, have interesting.
Have you seen this?
The new one?
Yeah.
Well, it's it's only three episodes.
It's the
episodes,
BBC version.
So.
Yeah. But they are 90 minutes of
you don't
meatiness.
Expect to live very long, do you?
Yeah, I guess. And that's why I said that's so pathetic, because I'm trying to get in the shortest things possible to watch.
The Wire.
As a last request, Mike, what would you like to see? You know, give me those three episodes of Sherlock.
All right, we'll wrap this up in just a few hours, and you can be out of here.
Hey, you could do that over your last meal, even. I mean, why not?
Long meal, but Italian meal.
But it is a fantastic show.
It is. It's great. I'm dying for the new series to come out. Here, it's already out in the UK. But
I finally started watching The Wire. I have to not watch it all at once because it's too much to take in.
Really?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of having a box set and the idea of watching episode after episode after episode, when they're originally meant to be aired weekly, there's something missing. It's almost too intense, especially when there's the recap in the first few minutes and all that sort of thing. The whole idea of engrossing yourself 8 hours at a clip or 16 hours at a clip, God forbid, watching a show, it's too much to take in. I mean, I really do need a slower pacing. It's like when you watch a show that has adverts in it, but you get the box set and it doesn't have adverts in it, but of course it does have the fades where the adverts should be.
Right.
And there's a natural timing there for the adverts because they know that they're going to be put in. And so when they're taken out, the timing gets wonky.
I had a phrase for that. Like, it drove me crazy that when those things did electronically being distributed, that they would not figure out, either they would do it mathematically too short or the pauses in between. I mean, sometimes it's a dramatic, like, oh my God, there's somebody outside. And then it just cuts, just like you said, it cuts back too soon. And I need that. And I was calling it either a black eye or an eye pause. I was just trying to come up with a phrase. You need a much bigger eye pause in there.
I love that. I'm definitely going to use the word eye pause in the future.
That's the one I went with, too.
Definitely. I think you should trademark that and
sell
it on T-shirts.
A company in China already has it.
Yeah, it is annoying. And there was one TV show I worked on, and they decided that they used a bumper of the name of the show with music, just a rock band, like that kind of a thing, and came back. And, of course, it's 2 minutes later, they come back from a commercial, and they play it again. And it didn't seem that disruptive. So in their minds, they decided, oh, we don't want to do that to people. So they just eliminated it. So what you would see is, for instance, you and me going, hey, we need to talk about this. And they just flash two black frames and then pick back up from the commercial again. And it's so I'm so disoriented. And I go, don't you guys actually watch this before you give it to iTunes or something? This is not right.
Yeah.
And that's where the iPods came from. But I did actually watch the first season of Lost that way. And you're right. There was something about, I guess I could go eat a sandwich if I wanted to after an episode was over, but it wasn't like waiting a week.
Right. Well, that's the whole thing. You know, you wait a week and it's that really great anticipation. You've got water cooler chatter to deal with, you know, and you sort of speculate with your mate, you know, oh, what about this character? What about that character? And, you know, you go off on a tangent and possibly into low Earth orbit trying to figure out what on Earth is going to happen to the characters or the plot. You know exactly what is going to happen because it's going to happen in 10 seconds.
Oh, not me, man. I watched Lost over like 2 weeks. Because I had to catch up before the finale because all my friends were coming over.
Oh,
so I watched it all back to back.
What do you think of content on demand? What do you guys think of that?
Big fan.
Yeah?
Big fan.
Would you ever go back the way it was?
You mean like broadcast only?
Yeah.
Well, oddly enough, I don't actually have a DVR. So despite the fact that I'm bathed in technology, I don't actually have a DVR. So normal television, I watch when it airs. But anything on video or what have you, you know, I'm a huge Netflix streamer, yeah, Amazon as well. It's so great because I just have I now have a collection that is larger than my physical collection.
Mike, I don't know what's wrong with him either.
Yeah, wait, hold on before you say that, because I was going to say, I even up him. I don't have a DVR and I just don't have cable. I just don't get it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
In order to have internet access. I need to have cable. Well, I don't need to have cable television, but the way they work the pricing tiers, they will charge you basically double for internet access if you do not have cable access.
So you don't even have a home phone line anymore either, and haven't for years. So if they were trying to call me to give me one of those deals, I wouldn't know it anyway. So I just
So you do everything you do is on demand, for lack of a better word?
Yeah, I think when Hulu started, I think I was one of those people that kind of got at the beginning and was sort of, I was like, this is fantastic. I guess I don't need to see it at that time. But I'm kind of one of those people, I do like knowing that at 8 o'clock Sunday night, this is going to be on. You sort of plan that thing. I did like it. But without having cable, of course, I just never saw much of anything. And then this world
You can still do it, though. I mean, I still do it. Like I watch Walking Dead live. It's being recorded just in case, but I watch it when it comes on, and I plan, you know. It's not entirely true, because I used to watch it. Now we're generally recording during it.
Right. Well, no, that's just it. I mean, and part of the reason why we record at 10 o'clock on Sundays is because The Walking Dead is over.
Well, not tonight.
And see, tonight, it's one of those things that since I don't have it, at 12:01 on iTunes, pink, there it is. And I have to stay up to see it tonight.
Perfect. What other shows do you wind up watching on iTunes?
That's the big one. I mean, that's the big one that I actually am looking forward to. Nothing else is coming to mind right now. You know, I didn't prepare for that.
Neither did I. Actually,
I was just aware of it tonight, but I'd be like, "Oh, isn't it airing relatively soon right now?"
Another high point I have to hit. Have you seen Boardwalk Empire?
No, didn't that just become available on Netflix?
I don't know.
Oh, it's iTunes maybe that it's available. I have not.
Oh, that would be really lovely.
It's very good.
Also, if you haven't seen it yet, Game of Thrones.
Yes.
One of my friends, Elizabeth, her friend, is one of the writers of that of show, and she always was talking about it, and I never saw it. And it's today I was watching the on Amazon Instant through Roku. They have a couple of freebies on there that's showing the making of it to sort of get you started. And so it was kind of an epic. I figured it'd be like 5 minutes long, and it was well over that, so I had to stop it. But
the series was absolutely wonderfully done. Yeah. Sean Bean is in it, and he basically plays the same character as he played in Lord of the Rings. It's kind of tragic, really.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
I think Sean Bean has died in everything he's ever done.
Spoilers.
Well, no, I mean, it's a book that's been out for like, you know, 15 years, so...
No,
you know,
I just can't. Come on. He dies in everything.
Yeah. Well, that's apparently that's what Sean Bean does. Yeah. He dies in everything.
So it actually isn't a spoiler. He died in Ronin. I'm not a huge sword and sorcery type fan, but all my friends were watching it, so I finally sat down and did back-to-back thing, and it's really good. So, highly recommend it.
Again, that's on my list. That's probably going to come before... The Wire, and it's probably going to come before Deadwood.
It's only, what, 7 episodes?
Yeah, it's not very long.
Yeah, it's not very long at all. Unlike The Wire, which, of course, is multiple seasons, and Deadwood, which was multiple seasons as well. I usually wind up watching one or two shows a year, like one or two special shows, like Walking Dead, for example.
Right.
Other than that, I'll have some television on, but it's mostly nonfiction. I'll have the Velocity channel on, and a lot of Home and Garden television, sort of... noise filler.
See, actually, Mike, the TV industry asked us to give you a call and talk you into watching some television. So.
Yeah, Nielsen family.
So we're done here. Yeah. Good night.
Actually, it'd be more like the cable company called and asked you to subscribe to something. Are you guys Mac people? Are you Mac people?
Yes.
Only?
At the moment, I am, but it's a weird situation because ultimately, you know, they're all tools, right? So if the Mac doesn't serve my purpose for something, I have no problem going over to Windows or going over to Unix, you know, like a Linux or something.
I am a staunch Mac user, but I'm a Linux user at home. And as you know, I'm dinking around with this Windows box for Creative Suite. So
yeah, we're both doing that.
But you're a Mac person, right?
Yeah, I can't even remember really using a Windows for anything, except like somebody would ask me, "Hey, could you print this?" And I just hit print, and that's it. I never think of using it for anything in any kind of creative bit. But of course, you know that I'll use the phrase bitching about Final Cut Pro.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, Final Cut Pro X. And once that happened, you know, I was using the phrase, I was like, it's like they're asking me to think so different that I'm like, how about a different computer system altogether?
Think about it, though. I mean, Apple's commitment to the higher-end situation, you know, higher-end creative content creation is currently a bit suspect. You know, and part of that is due to Intel. You know, they don't have the Xeon chips, and so therefore there's no new Mac Pros. But the Xeon chips are out and have been for a couple of weeks now. So theoretically, we should be getting new Mac Pros, but we don't know that for a fact. But also, the reality situation is that CPU power in general is so fast right now that you could just build off the shelf a very, very fast PC that is 95% as fast as the Xeon, you know, workstation equivalents for a quarter of the cost, and pop in, you know, NVIDIA graphics cards that aren't even available on the Mac,
right,
that will power the Mercury playback engine in the Adobe suite much faster than anything on a Mac. So for, you know, half the price or so, you get something that is going to work better, potentially, than anything you can buy on the Mac side.
You know, I don't know if you know this, but Dell had contacted me about this little program of trying. They wanted to have a computer, basically what you just said. We want to have a computer that is a default replacement to a Mac Pro. They did a whole presentation at South by Southwest, and they have found, well, I'm one of them, I don't know what the total count of people across the country is, to switch. And they've basically giving us a Precision Dell Precision computer to try out for 12 weeks. And basically, they've given us two for free. And we have no, we can complain about it if we want to. Whatever we want to do, just free license. But wow. they want to do what you just said, is have a system to do that. And so I said, I'm curious. You know I'm curious, and they found me because I bitch so much about that. And, you know, out of the gate, what you were saying, it, like, all that's so true, but I have to admit, some of the stuff that is missing from other companies that aren't Apple is the whole, kind of the overall experience. And this,
sure.
And this showed up. This showed up in a box, and, you know, 24 gigs of RAM installed in this thing. Like, I was just like, really? But in order for it to be, and I'm not saying this wouldn't be the way it'll be later. They may have us test this stuff and complain and fix all these things. But you know, I'm a Mac person, and when you replace it with a Windows machine and say, we think that you'll like this just as good, it doesn't read a Mac drive. So you have to buy a third-party program called Mac Drive in order for that part to work. So that's the first little annoyance. And then this one didn't come with a FireWire 800 card, which tends to be what a lot of these drives that we switch back and forth is, as opposed to USB. Just little things like that that I'm always like, Apple would have thought of that.
Yeah,
right.
They're very much a PC company, so those things probably never even crossed anyone's mind.
And that's why I feel like
it's not something to deal with day to day.
Yeah, that's why I feel like I'm such a pain in the ass to them, because I know last weekend I sent stuff, and I was just saying, from this point of view, when you take it out of the box, it would be cool if this was this way and this was this way. And it's not just the price of you know, the computers and the hardware and stuff. Somehow it's kind of the ease of the experience, and even opening the side of the case. It used to always be that you might as well just hammer the side of a PC case to get it open to play something in it. And now they're much better at that. I mean, this one, I know Walter Biscardi, he's got one of these too, and he said, not only is it easy to open a case, it's almost too easy. You could just sort of rub the top of it and the side would open up. And I said, so right, I think we got the same thing, because when I first got it, they wanted to put a DVD ROM in it, not a DVD-R. And of course I said, look, I know you're trying to replace a Mac Pro, but your media creators will at least need a DVD recordable in order to make DVDs for somebody, even in the smallest case. It should be Blu-ray at this point.
Sure.
Yeah, especially if it's a PC.
Yeah. And I said, so that's one of the things for your, whatever you're building, you know, to be the replacement for a Mac Pro that you want to hold your hand up and say, come and look at it. You better not put a DVD-ROM in it as a default. That's my thought on that.
I can't even understand why they would want to. It's not even the default on any desktops.
I know. And I said that just baffled me. Why was that there? But that's, I mean, that's the, I guess, shaking of the new paint, so to speak, that whatever they're trying to do, they're communicating, and it's happening.
In fits and starts.
Yeah.
Though. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, wouldn't it be cool if they did that?
Yeah.
You know, it's more than wouldn't it be cool. It's crucial. They need to do that.
Yeah.
you know, they need to put in FireWire 800 standard and several ports of FireWire 800. They need to put in USB 3, which of course isn't on a Mac Pro, but we're starting to see drives that are USB 3 coming out, and they're very fast. All those things need to be there out of the box without question.
Yeah, because
or at least to wean you off. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just like what you were saying is that here we are, we're starting a show or whatever. I don't want to chase down those parts. I don't want to wait for it to, oh, that's a special order. I kind of want that to be the checkbox in default.
Yeah, in the future, they could probably wean you off of this stuff. I mean, yeah. Because, you know, but at the moment, if they're looking for people to switch or they're looking for people who want to straddle both sides, then yeah, play both sides.
And this isn't their fault either. You know, Windows is just what gets used. So not having Mac readability, I guess, built into it, that's not completely their fault, but in the whole system. It just feels like that somebody should be screaming, hey, we have to make sure they have the ability to read a Mac drive because they are coming from Mac.
Now, exactly. To play devil's advocate, of course, the very fact, just like Avid did, you know, when they were doing the cross-promotional thing where you could buy Avid, you know, if you were a Final Cut ship.
Which jumper. They're still doing, I believe. Yeah.
But so to Dell's credit, at least they are thinking about this. I mean, and it's really weird for Apple to be in a position where people are watching their missteps because it's been a very long time since they've had to do that, except with iPod and iPhone.
I'm actually quite surprised that it's Dell that's stepping up to the plate, even.
They are stepping up. It's seemingly big time. This seemed really, really important to them. And I know that they wanted to have a panel at the South by Southwest to sort of introduce people who've already been doing it. I didn't get my computer till the week that, I guess it was almost 2 weeks ago now at this point. But there were people who had it before me, and they were at South by Southwest to talk about it. And, you know, the neat stuff is Adobe Creative Suite kicks ass. Finding a replacement for what Final Cut Pro did, for me, is not coming through. The closest thing is Premiere. For even the weird and unorthodox workflows that I would do to get things done faster or for a whole production, because I know that with Avid, you can edit and edit content. But usually in a whole group of things, there are things you don't have to worry about. But when you're an independent producer, you kind of have to make sure that a lot of that stuff is as close to everything in your box to get it done as possible. And that's why Final Cut was the tool that was hard for me to do without. And when they just drop it and replaced it with the end of life thing, not only did they cripple it so much, but they actually reinvented the whole way that you edit.
That's a good point, and something you and I kind of were yelling about on Twitter the other day. And I have this theory that there are two camps. There are the people who are saying, hey, this is the future, get on the bandwagon, you Luddites, and stop yelling at those kids to get off your lawn, which I appreciate in a way. It's the Apple way, you know, they abandon early, blah, 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 blah. But I think from the other side is people are saying, yeah, that's all well and good. That's coming, but it's not here now. And right now, I have work to do, you know, so I don't think those two camps are seeing eye to eye, because I know a lot of people who are chugging right along with X, but I totally just had to jump ship and, you know, and I went to Premiere.
Well, what made Final Cut popular in the first place was that it worked similarly to Avid, but at a price point that mere mortals could afford, and worked on hardware that anyone could afford. The whole idea of, oh, okay, well, you know, naturally it drove a lot of people toward Final Cut. And of course, Final Cut Pro 1 was not really a competitor to Avid in any real shape, way or form. But, you know, slowly over time, it built up and built up. And then an industry sort of almost evolved around it because it was cheap. It started being very capable. And when you abandon a product because you have to for some, you know, obviously the code base is really old and it just can't live on the new system, you know, on the new platforms anymore. That's one thing, except that if you've got an entire industry that has been working in a very particular way for so long, you can't just say, oh yeah, this is the new way of doing it going forward. Go crazy. Because an industry cannot turn on a dime like that. An individual person may be able to turn on a dime, but an industry cannot do that.
Yeah, especially broadcast.
I like that you referred to it as like the wife sort of thing. It'd be like, hey, here's my wife. She's getting long in the tooth. She needs a boob job. And then they come back and say, you know what? We just decided to give you a whole new wife.
Because this kind of wife is the future. The one you've had, not so much.
Now, how am I going to ask her where my pants are? She's never lived with me, you know?
She doesn't know where my pants are. Tickle your ass with a feather?
Yes.
You have pants?
Well, not while podcasting, but, you know.
I was going to say. It's also tradition that we don't wear trousers while podcasting.
It's very funny that you mentioned that because I am upstairs in this office that in the summertime is scalding hot. And there have been occasions where I will just sit here without pants and a jug of water while I do this. And it's good.
it's so good
this is audio podcast. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
I'm imagining you with a piece of straw in your mouth, chugging your jug of water like a hobo.
That's one of those hats that has straws on both sides and cups.
So how is the Dell thing going then?
It is interesting. Interesting is the right word. I'm not using it for anything super, super important right now. I have to admit it is difficult at first to mess with Windows. I started installing a dock at the bottom just to make myself feel a little more comfortable at home.
Oh, yeah. I saw that on your Twitter.
Yeah, just little things to sort of help me out. But I realized I'm not as stupid as I thought I was. And there are efficient things. For me, I guess if I was still going to choose, I hear about people who, I know this isn't possible, but I hear about people who have a PC, but then they install the Mac software on it and call that the Hackintosh. And somehow in there, I'm like, man, that sounds good.
I know a few people who've done it. The problem, though, is that it's very finicky.
Yeah.
You basically have to use one particular formula. If you have to use these particular parts, yeah, there's a little bit more diversity, but there's not the whole plethora of what you can have on the Windows side. And so if you're locked into a very small range of parts, then what's the point? I may as well just go back to a Mac and make sure that a genuine Macintosh and therefore have all my peripherals work and all the system updates work just fine without having to worry if the next thing is going to blow the machine up and all that mess.
Another adversary that I kind of feel is because it has nothing to do with Dell and has, well, maybe a little to do with Windows, but all the little software that you use during a production, you know, it seemed to be the Mac people, since they were more about creating, there was, although lesser software for the business side, there was more stuff for doing little things like, hey, here's something where you could strip the time code from a QuickTime movie. And it seems silly, but there are little things that you use to get by with. And now using a PC, if that's all I had and I could edit in Premiere, I can do that, but then little bells and whistles stuff that I relied on through the Mac, I don't have a replacement for those. And that has nothing to do with the computer system, you know, or Dell or anything else like that. It's just, I'm missing a lot of stuff and I don't have replacements for those things.
It's the total environment, and you can't just replace, you have to replace like for like. And right now, Dell is not replacing like for like. It's replacing some hardware bits and not your environment.
And some of that stuff is just, it's just not their fault. I mean, there aren't programmers who are making third-party stuff to do.
Right. They're still beholden to Windows.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen that in the past with Windows. You know, when you're on a Mac and you're doing, you know, regular people stuff, people will say, oh, well, why don't you use this or this or this while I'm on a Mac? But, you know, for the, like you said, the production side, there are so many of these tools out there, not to mention we have, you know, shell scripting on Windows and shell scripting on the Mac are totally different things. So before anybody yells that out. So all of that stuff has kind of grown up around, especially around, you know, video production. There's so many tools for conversion and things like that. In Dell's defense, you know, they are beholden to that. Here's free advice for you, Adele. Basically what Mike's saying is, if you want to take that market, you need to fill in the little gaps along the way too.
It'd almost be like a team of people who, well, kind of what we're sort of doing, I guess. I know it's a computer expense for their part, but we're kind of right now filling in for that team that maybe they don't have, answering those questions. Like, well, what are we missing? What do we need to do here? And those guys in the office will just, you know, hold up their pencils and do a couple little, you know, word processing things. But we're actually, I hope, not offending them by complaining.
Well, and again, in their defense, at least they are doing something.
Yes.
Well, I mean, they're soliciting your feedback. I mean, they want to do a good job. They don't want to do a crap job. So, of course, you know, if you've got a valid complaint or even, quite frankly, just want to bitch about something, they should be able to take that in kind.
Yeah, it seems to be that way. And I don't have, like I said, I haven't got a whole lot of mileage with it at this point anyway. But most of the stuff has nothing to do with the computer itself so far. And it runs a suite. What is this? This is the 2000 version. They gave me the 2000 version as opposed to the 4000 with the CUDA.
Oh, the Quadro 2000? Yeah. Right, yeah. Okay.
And so that's what I'm using. I installed Avid on it, too, just to try it. And I do notice the big difference. I hit play and that thing plays. And on my Mac Pro, which is older, it does take a second. And, and so I am noticing a quite a responsiveness in using the PC over the Mac. But I can't speak for everybody's computer. That's just my setup.
That's the thing as well. It's like the hardware is one small part of the total equation. And the fastest hardware in the universe will not necessarily get you to your end goal. It may get you there faster, but you need all the other parts to do it. And that's part of the problem with dealing with Dell. You know, they just make hardware. They're still beholden to Windows as an operating system. You're not also complaining to Microsoft.
Yeah.
And you're not also complaining to all the other indie developers out there who are making these small little widgets, you know, these tools for you that will fill in those gaps in your workflow.
Right. So you can't say, well, make this for Windows too, because they
go, right. It's out of their control.
You're so funny, Mike.
Yeah.
I think they will start to see that if there's enough of a migration. People are clamoring for it and say, hey, you know what? This whole PC thing, you know, it's got faster hardware. And it doesn't particularly look like Apple's interested in making giant trucks anymore, or they believe that the giant trucks are actually new iMacs, then maybe the tide will turn.
That's why I like this. That's why I really wanted to be a part of this, because I can't imagine myself using a PC if you would have asked me months ago. Never would have crossed up. And now here I am, and I'm like, wow, this is interesting. And it all really started from that whole experience of Final Cut Pro, how that could come to that, how that was such a terrible thing. But I know, as Maggie said, there are people who love it, and it just doesn't suit my needs. And right now, as many of these updates as they have, it still doesn't suit what I do.
Organizing and managing your media is faster and easier than with traditional editing applications like Adobe Premiere and Avid Media Composer. That's because those are built on old organization concepts.
I actually use it to do the secondary editing for this show. Oddly enough, it worked really well for doing very fast cuts for audio. And then the most recent version of it decided to have this really awful redraw bug. So if you currently have whatever you've got on your track playing and you try to make an edit, the waveform and all the thumbnails in the timeline go away.
Wow.
Yeah, good times. And the only way you can get it back is to stop playing. So you cannot actually edit while you're playing.
So you're saying that's really a useful feature.
Yeah. So that sucks. That easily adds 30% to my time editing.
And it only took you 6 months to get that bug.
Yeah.
And that's the weird bit. The prior version didn't have that problem.
That's crazy.
And it still doesn't do... Yeah, no, it's completely maddening. It's completely maddening. And it still, of course, doesn't do basic things like having a viewer and all the stuff that people are clamoring for who have a workflow that's much, much more complicated than my own.
Yeah, the viewer is the thing that just kills me most of all right now. And I know they said we're never going to get it. And I have a friend who's really trying to make it work. And every now and then I'll crack it open and then I'll send back two questions. He goes, yeah, they don't have that yet. And one of the things that just bugs me is just, I like to know what the source time code is of something. And I'm like, what's the easiest way? Because normally you could just load it up in the viewer window and you could read the source. Oh, there's no viewer window. That's annoying. And actually, it's really annoying. I wish they just put the damn viewer in it.
If I recall correctly, and I tend not to use the bins like this, but I think there are extended attributes where you can see all of that at once. But don't quote me on that. And besides, that's one problem that you have with it that may or may not be solved. There are countless more that cannot. So right now, it is meant for and is useful for a very, very small audience of what the original Final Cut Pro was.
Well,
and that's a valid reason to bitch.
Yeah, I mean, if I can get on my little soapbox for a second, I mean, I think, in my opinion, that Final Cut Pro 10 is not the great uniter that Final Cut Pro 7 was. I think it's dividing the market up again, that Final Cut Pro had, you know, stolen so much of this from Avid and whatever else was left over in the time. But now you've got people who are disgruntled who are going back to Avid. Avid is, you know, making it easy for them to do. You've got people who can't quite work in Final Cut Pro 10, so they're moving to Adobe. And then you have the people that are happy with Final Cut Pro 10 and new people who needed something a little bit more than iMovie. So instead of having more people, I think you have a more split market again. I mean, this really has been the best thing to happen to Avid in years.
And Adobe. I mean, people never really took Premiere very seriously.
I don't know if you know, Mike, but I used to bitch about Adobe so much, but I've been singing their praises recently.
Again, they are saying, we're here and we're going to make it work. And I said, that's really, if I have to choose something today, it's Premiere and then that whole suite as a replacement for me doing like another show or anything right now. That's what I would use.
Yeah. For my purposes, it's still a little bit weird. It's a little bit foreign to me, but that's just because I haven't really sat down with it. Last time I gave Premiere Pro, Premiere prior to the Pro thing was, you know, Premiere 4.2 on a Mac 840 AV. So it's a bit of a long time ago. People are bitching about Apple abandoning the high-end creative market, but Avid abandoned the Mac and Adobe abandoned the Mac as well. Yep. And the neat part about it is they're back, which is great. But you know, it's not like they haven't screwed us in the past. You know, and I think a lot of people forget that.
But in the end, it's really about, you know, what you got to do today.
There are three viable editors out there: Final Cut Pro 7, Premiere Pro, and Avid, and Media Composer.
You said Final Cut Pro 7. Was that intentional?
Yes.
Okay. Just checking.
Well, but I mean that because it's not. Yeah. No, because Final Cut Pro 10 is not viable for the vast majority of the professional market. Now, if you're an indie and you're just doing your own thing yourself, soup to nuts, like if you're, you know, if you are the camera operator and you are the editor and you are the post person,
then it's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it does add a lot of alacrity to your workflow. But I don't know anyone, aside from people who are just sort of dinking around doing their own thing, I don't really know anyone who is the sole soup to nuts person. There's always at least two or three people involved. If there's more than one person involved, you kind of can't do it. I mean, FCPX is meant to be a self-contained entity.
You know, when it came out, I said if you looked at it as though somebody gave an assignment, and that is take everything that's complicated about an editing system that somebody just couldn't walk up and do and build that, but underneath the architecture of it being really simple, that you could drag stuff and just put it in. And golly willikers, this is fantastic. But then underneath, you could do more complicated things. And if that was the assignment, that's what they were trying to do with it. But it still is a consumerish editing program with these added... I don't know how far they're going to go with it to make it have pro features. And I know I get in trouble by saying pro because I was told a lawyer is a professional and he can use it to edit with. And when I say pro, you know what I mean, that they're using it for a...
Yeah, and the people who are giving you crap for saying that know what you mean, too.
Yeah, yes. And so...
They just want to give you crap.
That's exactly what happens. As an assignment, I think it's really inventive. If that was your thesis at school, that you were going to invent an editing system that everybody could just sit down and start using, and it had some pro features in it, and that's what it came out. I was like, wow, that's really impressive. But in the real world sense, I still hate it, so...
Right, and to kind of play devil's advocate for Apple, although not in a very strong way. I mean, this is a company that does that. They like to go and, all right, we're going to reinvent this. First, they look at the rest of their product line. So what are they seeing? And they're seeing that their own move towards mobile devices. In a way, it's kind of clear where they start to pull this thing in. It just doesn't bode well for people like you and me and Christopher. And, you know, I have braids in, you know, in my setup, and they're useless. They're not useless now because I have something that supports it, but I can see sort of what's on their mind, but it's just, you also never know how far they're going to go. Like you say, how far they're going to bring Pro into it, or if they're not, if they're going to push it more consumer. That's the worst in part.
I have this crossing of thoughts though about, I had read that Apple doesn't do market research. So they don't actually look to see what anybody's interested in or whatever. For the most part, they look to Steve. And Steve suggested what he, you know, what he wanted to do with the company, and was such a entity that it worked, and he made stuff work. There's failures, but for the most part, they're not looking to see what the next big thing is. And I looked up a quote from, I think it was in an article too, that Henry Ford said, if I asked everybody what to do about automobiles anyway, he said, if I would have asked them something about transportation, and if I would have did market research, people would have said, make a faster horse. Because in their minds, they never would have thought to make why would a car be on my mind? So I think about that, and I think that's so interesting because it's so different from most every other company that invents or puts out anything in the United States, and there's and has such this positive response to it. But then I look at it in like the filmmaking sense, where now they won't the you know a director or the auteur of even films that doesn't happen anymore. It's getting less and less. So it's so much of everybody putting input on it. They are doing market research for films, and I said the art of some of that stuff is just being the person who is the best at getting all the demographics together in one project is the best the way it is now. And that just makes me sad. That was my soapbox, oh, yeah. I think.
Well, I mean, you know, that's it's true. And they've, you know, they've always, well, they not always, but in recent years have said, you know, we're not a business computer company. Yet they had gotten into the business of filmmaking. But when we say tools, we're talking about literal tools for the people who do this as their day-to-day job. You know, and they've started taking, well, all right, technically they didn't take any tools away, but they put you on a path. And then the next set of tools came in and they're much smaller and there are fewer of them. And wait, you promised us this path, you know, so they are in that business of business, at least as far as video production. And maybe that's where they're just kind of like, you know, we shouldn't have done that. I don't know. It, you know, no one knows the mind of Apple now, especially, but it's kind of a, to me, it's really all up in the air.
I read a Twitter today from somebody, I think it's Frank Jonan, I think that's how you say his name, and he said that it's scary to him now that Apple is more creating products for media consumption than media creation. Do you think that's accurate?
I think they've always done the consumption part. I think that's always been important to them, but I don't know how much of creation they're focused on. I mean, they like to own it end to end. They do like that, but...
It also depends on how you want to look at it, because you can say, on one hand, well, they've always had, well, not always, but they've had a significant focus on the content creation side and still do. iMovie is on every Macintosh ever sold, you know, since the dawn of iMovie, since the iMac, right? If that's the case, then there's theoretically they're still trying to foster content creation. They are making these tools that are very, very easy to create content.
For However, consumers.
Well, for consumers, right, exactly. And I think that's, but that's also the other democratization, which is, well, instead of the few pumping out films on a large scale to movie houses, distribution, etc., why can't everyone distribute via Vimeo? Or via iTunes or what have you. I mean, that seems to be their mindset. It's more of a democratization of video tools and getting people to consume them more easily.
Well, and, so and that's great, except for, you know, of course, the fact that they've also been producing these professional tools, you know. So that I really like that, everything you just said. I really like that. And I think it's good for humanity, you know, more creative people. We find creative people through meritocracy versus, you know, some artificial thing put together by people in suits.
Right. But at some point in time, you've got to step it up, right? You've got to go from iMovie to the next level. You know, you've outgrown iMovie. You can't make Star Wars an iMovie.
No.
You know? So if in your mind you want to make Star Wars, what is the tool that is going to get you there?
And maybe in Apple's mind, they don't want you to make Star Wars on a Mac anymore. But they want you to make the Star Wars parody on Final Cut Pro 10. And then we professionals need to seek employment elsewhere. Maybe that's what they're looking at.
Because, I mean, ultimately, it's about money. They're a publicly traded company, so it's got to be about money on some level. For the most part, it's we make money because we make compelling products, which is great, except that they cannot be profitable making expensive professional software. So they're not going to put a lot of time in it versus Adobe or Avid, which that is their bread and butter. The professional market is how they get revenue.
That's why the other kind of source, I know it's a little bit off, but the music industry, if we three had a band, music cannot be our product right now. It has to be a tool to advertise something else, our concert or something that people haven't thought of yet, but it can't. And like you said, Avid and Adobe, that's what they do is they sell software. So they will have to fight and struggle for that market where when Apple was doing it, they could afford to give the software away because you still needed that big dongle of a computer in order to use it.
Right, the $3,500 Mac Pro dongle. Yeah.
I don't know what happened to you, Mike. It used to be about the music.
I'll pitch him, because at times he drives me crazy, but there's a guy named Bob Lefsetz, and he has this, he doesn't do it as a blog, he does it as an email, and sometimes he'll email you 8 times a day these thoughts about the music industry, and he has lots of really, really big music people following him. A lot of times he'll piss somebody off, and then he'll announce that they left him, but he talks about this kind of stuff, and it does pertain to, mostly to music. When he does dabble in the music industry, I know I end up writing him and say, yeah, I don't think this is your thing. I don't think you should be talking about the movie industry, but I recommend that if you give it a shot. Just Bob Lefsetz, look him up.
Interesting. Because I think, I mean, there are clearly a lot of parallels, right? So we've reached the democratization where of music where anyone in their own bedroom can record a multi-track song and have it sound nearly as good or just as good as having it come out of a large studio, depending on the talent of the particular person.
That would be true, yes.
Yep.
Why do you need the music companies for distribution? For I can distribute my song via BitTorrent or via my own website or what have you. Because Apple really did bring this to the masses with regard to music. Yes, it existed prior to that, but they were really the ones that sort of pushed it and said, hey, you know what? Music is worth a dollar. You know, it's kind of a bit of a race to the bottom as well. And I think that's hitting a lot of the industry. Your job is not necessarily to make music. Your income stream primarily is not going to be your music. It's going to be concerts or t-shirts or what have you. And it seems to me that they want, or they have an eye to do the same thing to the film industry.
Right.
Yeah.
To try to get them to make things still very high quality, but cheaper. Instead of distributing them through the cinema, just distribute them through iTunes.
But I also think that's also the sociology of how we deal with stuff now, is that because we can have a blog and voice our opinions, everybody can reasonably get access to that really easily. So they're not so interested in listening to somebody who maybe went to journalism school or an English major or something that got some job. Like, that importance has lessened. And the idea that now, not going to the movies anymore because I can click into YouTube and see something that somebody had made, that is I mean, it's already reaching the masses anyway. They do expect that to be right there. And the cinema idea is kind of maybe dying away.
Well, I would agree with some of that. I think it's taking away some of the idle interest in cinema. But I mean, at the end of the day, when someone goes to see a movie, there is a level of quality that they expect. I mean, and for audio, I'm not dissing musicians. The technical, and I don't mean musicianship, the technical barriers for entry are much, 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 much lower than they are for what we consider a mainstream film. Because like you said, Christopher said, you can record in your bedroom and it will sound great. So there's your barrier of technical entry right there. Everything else is just marketing and you have the internet, blah, 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 blah. But there still is a much higher barrier for the equivalent of a CD in the film market. It didn't just take, you can't really, well, you probably can do some movies in your bedroom. I mean, but
I think we've all seen those films.
Yes. I think Mike might have edited one of them.
No.
Oh dear, yes.
No. But for the MPAA, the RIA was it canary in the coal mine, but that canary is in a much deeper coal mine. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think that is the biggest problem there. Is it may come in the next few years where tools get better and better, but for right now, I don't think that for the average Joe, that's not there. And there's still just so much more that goes into it.
See, I agree with you completely. What I think what I was meaning is that you represent an informed opinion. I think that we all represent an informed opinion, but like in a common sense, those people don't see the difference between the two mechanically. Like on paper, they're just like, if I get this camera,
yes. Right.
And that's the part that's kind of like, I don't want to say education, but the whole education of why movies are different. That's the part that I think is sorely just kind of going away, because if you're not that informed in it, you think it's the same thing. Because
they try to make their own
right
movie.
That's exactly right. And so if you never even bother, there's no way to even know that it's not the same.
Or until they start saying, well, so-and-so made a movie, it's on Vimeo, and like, oh, it's right. But that new, the new Adam Sandler movie is better.
Oh, dear God. That's not okay.
My friend used to...
That never happens.
My friend used to be at Columbia College in Chicago, was a person that when they bring people in to see if they were going to decide to go to that film school or not. And so there was a point where they just hated Robert Rodriguez, because every time a mother or a father would bring their kid in and go, look, why are we paying this much money for this film school? Because this Rodriguez guy, $7,000, he's put a movie in movie theaters. And she said, I'd always have to keep explaining, no, it costs more than $7,000 to get the movie in the movie theater. That's not, you know, that's what he used to pay for the film and all this other stuff. But many of those things that were gone into that in order to make a film print across the theater was not under the $7,000 umbrella. That was, she said, we hated hearing that.
Well, it's the apocryphal Picasso joke where he's asked to, you know, draw on a napkin for someone, and then he asks him for a heap of money, and they go, but you just scribbled that out in 10 seconds. He's like, yeah, but it took me 50 years to learn how to draw like that.
Yeah, that's great.
Your hourly rate is your hourly rate because of your talent and your skill and what you bring to the table. It has very little to do with the tools that you happen to have at your disposal. It's important to know the tools well and to use them effectively. You can teach someone how to use Final Cut Pro in a day. You can't teach them how to edit film in a day.
Yeah, my comment to that always to them was like, yeah, but how many other 7,000 movies have you heard about in the last 3 years?
And is your kid as talented as Robert Rodriguez?
I mean, that's basically what it was. It's like, that's not the factor. It's Robert Rodriguez that's the factor.
And people just do not find value in that. Or they don't immediately assume value in that until it's brought to their stark attention like that, because they think this is some money, you know, $7,500 to make a film. They don't understand that there's distribution, there's duplication costs, there's a whole litany of things that go on, and their understanding of the industry is so incredibly myopic as to be a rounding error. In my line of work, it's the same thing. It's where, well, can't you just, you know, bang this thing out for like 10 grand or so? I'm like, you know, it's like, oh, well, you know, I can hire a kid out of college to write this stuff for me for $10 an hour. And I'm like, you know what? Theoretically, you could, except that it's not going to be as good. And you're going to wind up having a really crap product because of that. It's the same thing elsewhere. You know, people come to you all the time, I imagine, and say like, oh, yeah, your rate's too high or whatever. And it's like, well, my rate's my rate. I've earned this rate. And if you are not looking to pay for it, then you can fuck right the hell off.
I always find the big adversary is when people call you and ask you for something that over the past 10 years of all your work, you figured out something, and it's something that you could actually just tell them in one sentence. All that work that went into that little thing that you achieved it, and somebody else just wants it without that discipline. How do you charge for that?
Yeah, that's the big problem. And because they think that you can do this in a half an hour or an hour or whatever. And even if you can, it's the experience that you have that allows you to do that in a half an hour. It gives you the understanding of doing it in half an hour. We all use tools differently. I was looking at your Tumblr and I was noticing your Final Cut Pro trick.
It's kind of like a word processor. I think that's probably a good way to explain it, is that if you have a lower track, and I needed to have a bug or a lower third over three of these shots, but not on the other shots, I actually just lay the graphic out and I duplicate it twice. I move one part up and delete the inverse, move that up and delete it. And within seconds, I now have everything perfectly cut to the frame of what your goal is. And that's the simple part, because I would do it for other very complicated things. For instance, I found a way that if you worked in DV anamorphic, but you were going to do work in high def, and people did motion moves in Final Cut, and sort of that was what was going to stick. If you had to go through and redigitize all the HD stuff, I know people, this is back when you were actually doing offline and online, but if you had to go through and do all that, I figured out it would take two guys about 2 weeks to go through and duplicate everything that was in a project, redoing those motion moves, either through After Effects or something else. So I nested them, and because Final Cut Pro worked off of accessing the full resolution files to a hard drive, if you paste them into a higher res sequence, it still goes back to it. So by nesting those things and cutting it like that, I could paste that, scale it up in a higher res project, and the resolution was taking it from the hard drive file, not from the project file.
That's really right. Clever.
And so so what happened was, is in an emergency, instead of 2 weeks worth of work, I figured out if I just did this little trick and did this with fades even involved in it, it took 6 minutes.
And that tiny little trick that took what? It took 2 minutes to explain and probably 6 minutes to accomplish. Yeah. That is precisely what your talent and your understanding and thorough knowledge brings to the table.
Right. It's exactly the same thing when people go out and they try to hire someone to design a website. You know, and they go, oh, well, that's too much. So they go out and they get someone who's going to take twice as long to do it for just a little bit less per hour, and they end up paying more. What you've done there is you've illustrated that what makes you who you are and makes your rate is that you know how to do things, you know, more efficiently than someone who's charging less, you know? You get what you pay
for. And you wind up with, right, exactly, you wind up with a better product.
And by the way, I didn't realize that you had worked on the Tingler documentary. I've seen that. I'm a real big fan of that, actually.
Yeah, that was so. I have to. Jason Schwartz, Jeffrey Schwartz, who made that. I think he started that. I may say this wrong, but I think he actually started that out of high school, in a love for William Castle. And that documentary spanned from 8mm VHS all the way up to Betasp and digital video. Like, he had years worth of interviews with people. It was in different shapes, and it was kind of one of those things where it'd be like, can you make this look like, you can't make it look like it's shot on digital video now, but can you just make people accept it and go through the whole thing? And he was really worried. And when it screened at AFI, just watching on the screen, he said, it was like, I never thought about the quality of any of this footage. I just watched it. And as you know, that won AFI's People's Choice Award.
Yeah, it was great. Wow. I'm a huge sci-fi nerd, and I stumbled on it because I knew who William Castle was, but I stumbled on it because Forry Ackerman's in it, and mm-hmm. I just happened to be reading something about Forry and happened to just watch a Castle film, and I'm a notorious surfer, you know, and so I just stumbled on it. I'm like, oh, this looks awesome. And I had no idea he worked on it.
My understanding now is that it was in a William Castle box set, and that's the way that it got distribution, but I understand that it is going to be available as its own entity now, as a Spine Tingler documentary on its own. It's really entertaining, and if you've seen it, there was stuff about that. I didn't even really make the connection that William Castle and Orson Welles were friends.
Right. Well, and you didn't really realize how, I mean, it's a very specific part of the industry at a very specific time, but you didn't realize how influential this one guy was, too.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Even to the point where Hitchcock was sort of nervous about a William Castle movie coming out.
Well, because he was a great promoter, yeah. You know. People don't know. It's called Spine Tinglers, the William Castle story. It's brilliant. I highly recommend it.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Phantom Edit. I mean, it's kind of the thing that, at least in nerd circles, what you're probably most famous for.
Yeah.
It was produced a while ago, and I think it's still holding up. I was actually quite surprised. I was doing a little bit of additional research recently on it because I wanted to, you know, have it fresh in my mind and such for today. It seems like people are still very, very much talking about it. Surprised me. Usually things, even if they're good fan homage stuff, tends to die out after a while, but according to the BitTorrents and according to various sites, it's still very much a hot topic. So congratulations on that.
It's strange. Merlin Mann, we just talked the other day, and he kind of came into experience in this stuff and was really jazzed about it. I guess he'd seen many of these things, and I was reminding him of, at that time, it seems cool and fun to talk about now, but at that time it was really scary. Because I was just a poor guy in my apartment, and I didn't have any way to get anywhere. So I would sit at home and I would mess with this. And to the point where technology just caught up enough that I could barely hold enough footage on a Final Cut Pro home computer system to do this. The world was just, there was no YouTube, and the idea of suing was a lot more out there. And internet was sort of, you know, with the music industry, with Napster and stuff, that was a big fear. And then all of a sudden this little, it was just a VHS tape that I made. And you hand it to five friends who were watching it at parties. And it went on for months, and people talking about it. And it was all then kind of about it was about editing. And it was about that kind of stuff. And then when I got into mainstream, the idea of it being, I will say, more of like a novelty, the idea that somebody did it more than anybody even seeing it and commenting on it. And I felt that was something I was just going to have to live with for a long time, because I did spend a lot of time with it. And if I watch it now, of course, I'm embarrassed and would like to change different things about it, but I won't. I won't ever do that.
You won't say make a special edition out of it?
No, no. It serves.
You won't, as they say, Lucas it.
Yeah. Even when, even the idea, which I thought was so funny, is, because it was a VHS, of course, the picture was really, really wonky and bad. And the DVD sort of opportunity that I could be like, I could just sort of make it a little better quality. That's all I wanted to do. But the guy even changed the DVD release. So much.
I know.
So that you couldn't even duplicate it. I mean, the footage wasn't even the same. And I have a collection of, I think I've bought just about every Star Wars version, even the one that's called the definitive version on Laserdisc, which in fact it's not, of all the different releases that are out there. And it's a huge stack of media. There, that movie has not one solid version. I know that, like, I can't remember what year it was, but in the early 2000s, they were doing a LA screening of films that represent a decade, two films. And it was The Godfather and Star Wars. And they sold tickets that they were going to play the original version of Star Wars. And so all these people were like, oh, that's great. We finally get to see that, not that special edition crap. And that got blacklisted. He said, I can't give you the old one. I can give you the new one.
Oh, no.
So it was an event that people came to. And when I was there, he showed up and brought some of the cast and things to sort of appease the whole idea of that. But it did get booed when they were announced that they were not going to show the original 1977-ish version. They were going to show the special edition, and people were like, boo.
Have you seen some of the other fan restorations, like the Harmy edits and all that?
No, but I think that's like really interesting stuff. I was saying now that sometimes at a point in a movie, because people now have such high opinions of things and the ability to give their opinions, that it's almost like now at the beginning of a movie, it's almost like the filmmaker would have to announce why they did something and what their goal was. And then when the movie's over, you'd be like, wow, they really hit that goal. Because I'm like, you know, if I tell you that the whole goal of Phantom Menace was to sell action figures to kids and basically piss off at adults, you'd say, hey, man, that's a really successful movie.
Man, that George Lucas, he is right on top
right.
of it.
Right, like if you looked at it that way. And so I think that some of these people doing these different cuts, they have a mission or an assignment or agenda that they're trying to achieve. And even though each one will be different, you know, the guy, he basically says, oh, you know, George Lucas did a restoration of the films, but what about this? What about this? And doing that stuff. I mean, I think it's really neat. It certainly is not something that is lackadaisical, because it does take a lot of work.
The one sort of my personal favorite, and we've talked about this on prior episode, the Harmy despecialized edition. You know, the length at which he went to go through and find 70mm prints, 35mm film, the original plates, the original background plates. So he found high-resolution scans of the background plates, so he was able to redo shots entirely in After Effects and really get it to the original 1977 version that is just absolutely stunning to look at. There are a few things here and there that needed to be changed slightly just due to lack of footage or just lack of cover or what have you. In general, I think it was just absolutely fantastic. Prior to that, there was the Dr. Gonzo versions, which, you know, they took source material from, what was it, the French Laserdisc, the original, it was a bunch of other old analog sources, and that was the best version that could happen at the time. And then this one Czech guy, you know, took half a year or a year or so to do the original trilogy, and it completely blew my doors off. It was absolutely amazing.
It is a thing of beauty. You should really take a look at it. The biggest difference, I think, what people should understand is Mike's edit of Phantom Menace is more about the edit, tightening the movie up and making it better, whereas Harmy's was to take it and make it as close to the original as possible and restore all that, you know, had been changed. And it really is a beautiful thing, and it's also in high def, so that makes it even better.
With the Phantom edit, it turned a film that was dragging and boring and absurd, and turned it into something that is watchable.
I read a lot of stuff from Lucas and philosophies, and watched a lot of interviews, and I had done that, you know, most of my life. So watching that movie, I know that you've heard some of the stuff I said about it, and it was, you're breaking your own rules, and so I was trying to keep it as close to not being my perspective on what to do as much as if we were working together, and it'd be like, why isn't this working? And then I'd be like, well, I think maybe what's happening here, you wouldn't do that. This is not like a Star Wars movie that you would have put out. And trying to put those values that were missing that were previous in his other versions of films into that was kind of the goal, especially of that one. Because the joke was always, they said, if you wanted to make a, you know, if I wanted to make it completely interesting, what did somebody say? You just loop the lightsaber battle for 2 hours. You know, that was like a, you know.
Which was weird because I thought the lightsaber battle was not particularly interesting. I thought it was, I just didn't like it. Well, I thought it was artificial.
Yeah, it was the part of the toy selling, you know, in a way. I mean, hey, Darth Maul, look, he's got a double-ended lightsaber. Let's fight.
And the whole artificial idea of the four shields separating everyone, I mean, it was very dramatic. But at the same time, these are people who wield lightsabers that can pretty much chop through anything. And yes, while the energy field, it may not be able to go through the energy field, the things that are emitting the energy field are right there. The whole thing just seemed rather silly and overly acrobatic, I suppose. You know, the fight coordinators, I mean, it was really quite fascinating to watch, but at the same time, if you are this quasi-magical being, you know, capable of doing all these things at once, shouldn't you fight in a fundamentally different way than humans fight?
Which they did in the very first, and then not from there out. But I had to make an admission to Mike today that I'd only seen bits and pieces because someone way back when had it, and I saw, I think the first, I told you, the first thing I saw was that the quote-unquote outtake of Jar Jar getting it over the falls.
Yeah.
And that, I was like, oh, well, I'll watch that. But but I really disliked the movie so much that I just really didn't want to sit down and watch. And so I watched bits and pieces of The Phantom Menace. But, and today, I finally started it from the beginning. And I have to say, it really is so much tighter.
And listening, and specifically listening to your voiceover through the entire thing, because the dialogue, regardless of, you know, the tighter edits and such, which is, you know, certainly it makes it flow a lot better and it's a lot tighter and it's a much more engage. It's even much more engaging. The problem, though, is that the dialogue itself is crap.
Yeah.
There's no amount of editing that can fix that. And there's no amount of good acting. I mean, these are very, very talented actors and actresses.
Well,
and
except for
the
one.
Dialogue is just bad. Well, yeah, sure.
Balaba Numatapa.
Mannequin Skywalker.
There was this movie called Fair Game years ago that had Cindy Crawford doing her film debut. And they gave her a line to say it. Everybody said how awful she was in it. And if you watch it, kind of everybody, Billy Baldwin's in it, Hector Elizondo, I think that's how you say his name. Everybody's awful in it. And I remember they gave her a line that she's shot at by people, and Billy Baldwin is sitting with her, and he goes, well, whoever these people are who are trying to kill you, they're definitely professionals. And she looks to him and says, well, at least I'm important enough that they hired professionals to try to kill me. And you just go, wah, wah. But I'm like, nobody could pull off that line. Like, it's just stupid. It's just stupid. So I always felt bad that, I don't know if she had the chops to really do that, but that was not a fair, that was just not a fair thing. And I think that much of that movie is not fair for any of those people. If that was their only movie, they'd never work again.
Well, right. in the original movies, I guess, you know, Lucas had people pushing back against the dialogue. Notoriously, you know, the three leads pushed him all the time on it. And then, of course, they had that rapport by the second and third movie, so they could continue to do that. But in Phantom Menace, I mean, George Lucas is this godlike figure who's come back to resurrect the great god Star Wars from its death and bestow it upon the people. So, you know, I'm sure he didn't have that same sort of, you know, pushback. So he just, whatever. Whatever he said was golden.
I think that went to the crew and everything, everybody involved. He said, hey, we're going to have something fly out of somebody's ass. He'd be, that's a great idea. Like, how would you know?
And the other thing I thought was, you know, it was one of the first all green screen films. It was very obvious that the actors were having a big problem, you know, dealing with that. They're supposed to act staring at a tiny foam ball, you know, or something, and meanwhile it's going to be this gigantic creature or what have you. Everything just seemed really green screeny and out of place and slightly unfortunate.
I'm sending you guys a picture in the queue here that somebody gave me. It's George Lucas through different dates. One of them sitting in front of these actual tangible models, and then the next one, of course, it's just him in front of a green screen. This is my movie.
You know, and it does says a lot. I mean, I'm not one to knock CGI. I think it certainly has its place. And even in Phantom Menace, if you watch, like, I was noting some of the pod racing stuff with these virtual characters was very, very, very good. But it's just losing sight of the whole thing. And, you know, and of course he was trying to, you know, break new ground, which he likes to do, and bully for him. But it was a real stretch, I think, for the cast.
Well, the other part of it is that when you are recreating something from whole cloth virtually, you have to add in all the proper physics, because in the real world, you just get the physics. You know, if you drop something, it falls at 9.8 meters per second per second. That's what gravity does. But in the virtual world, you've got to add all that in yourself. And so the tiny, subtle things that humans pick up on subconsciously aren't necessarily incorporated into those, you know, into those equations. And so it looks lacking.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's, I'm about to sound like I'm defending Phantom Menace, but, you know, it really wasn't like a Jar Jar looked fairly real to me. I mean, I think the hardest part with him was lighting was sometimes uneven, but a lot of the stuff, you know, really worked. But again, like you say, I mean, you threw this cast into something that really hadn't been done before, and it does tell in places. Of course, they used a lot more practicals in that, in the first one, than they did in the second, if my understanding is correct, so I don't know.
Well, you were saying about the of it being a success as a 3D character. Of course, I'm the one that's like saying it's not a success because it was a terrible character that actually would stop the film to let him do something and then start the film.
Oh, that was awful.
Yeah. That's all the stuff that there is a quote before. I think you can probably find it on YouTube, actually. It's George Lucas saying that the reason these other science fiction films fail is because they spend so much money and time on the sets and the characters and the costumes that they generate that they want to spend screen time on it. And that is not story or plot. That's just showing off. And that's why he was a success at it. And when I watch those movies, it's so not him. This is, hey, let's stop the movie to let you see how cool the lighting, how hard we've tried to create this character in 3D space that's interacting with actors in front of a green screen, that we'll actually stop the film and show it to you.
Well, and that's why you cut out the part where Jar Jar is doing the double Lindy into the water.
Yeah, yeah.
It was stuff like that made it so much better. Just getting rid of the superfluous pandering scenes.
Right, all those jokes. Suddenly Lucas is all about jokes and jokes and jokes. I know there's one scene after where, you know, where they're getting in, you know, Amidala's ship, and they have to free the pirates. So they're trying to free them from all these battle droids. So that goes on, and they fight them, and they all cut them down to size, and there's a run up. And in the very corner of a frame, there's the little joke of the guy, the two legs still walking. Very subtle. That was kind of humorous, but there was so many other jokes in this thing that were just like, oh, you know, like groany jokes. You're just like, why?
It was a separation of the fourth wall as well. I mean, effectively, because it took you out of the film.
That's almost all that stuff. It's as simple as that is. I mean, if they would have moved all that stuff out of the movie, part of the reason that people hated it so much would have been gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I mean, as it stood, the Phantom Edit wound up being over 2 hours.
No.
I mean, I guess, oh, you know what? It was 2 hours including the credits, the end credits.
It's about 21 minutes shorter than the actual runtime of the film. I think it's 153. I think it's 153.
It didn't feel like it was shorter.
Yeah.
Which is also a good thing. It didn't feel rushed. It just felt like a better overall experience.
Yeah, it didn't feel like it was shorter, but it certainly didn't feel as long as it did before. There's so many parts that I did remember from the movie, and so those things would start, and I'd be, oh, here we go. And then they would be over, and I'm like, oh, great.
Well, to me, it was very clear that when you were doing this, you weren't doing it as an exercise to edit something. You know, it wasn't to edit a thing. It was very clear that you had a love of the history of Lucas or what have you, that you wanted to give this film that love.
That's fair, yeah. And ultimately, the audience was just me. That's how it started, yeah.
So you gave yourself the love.
Yeah. Basically, I just kind of felt like there was something better in this by even just applying his own ideas to it, that if I tried it, and I guess the technology was just on the line at the time to make that happen, it just kind of ended up doing the whole thing.
I also appreciated the fact that it felt more like the earlier movies. I'm not exactly sure. Some of the transitions, I don't know if you did them differently, and because I don't know the Phantom Menace well enough to tell, but it certainly did feel like it fit in better with the earlier movies. I don't know what it is, or something about it, a feel to it that was very much more like them than the later movies, which I always see in my head as just giant video games.
Yeah, I even got blamed. There is one that's about 3/4 through the movie, and somebody said, "Oh, that's the one that you did that sucks." And I said, "But that's the one I didn't do. That's actually the movie."
I guess the unanswered question, or the unasked question, is: were you satisfied with the edit?
You asked me that today, you know, but back then, I guess it wasn't a contest, or like it wasn't anything that probably anybody was really supposed to see. So I wasn't putting any pressure on it. And I just was still thinking that if I was working in that office, these are things I would like to suggest. Whereas I read a book where George Lucas talked about editing unreleased versions of his friend's movies, giving them back to him, saying, "This is where I think that you messed up from what you were originally trying to do." And I didn't think it was that much different. The notoriety that happened with it, although people said that's the greatest thing in the world, I said it comes with that sort of criminal side to it, is then it became sort of a novelty. Because of that, I almost just wanted to push it. I said, if I have a chance to give this to him, I totally want to give it to him. And then it all turns into something else and it all falls apart. So I've never, ever spoken. I've never spoken to him or really anybody from Lucasfilm. That's never happened.
I've always thought that if you're a creator, if you're creating art or you're creating something, you know, call it something else, ultimately, you have to be happy about your own creation. Other people may like it and that may be great, but when I take a photograph, I'm really doing it for me. And if I'm okay with it, then it's satisfied my goals. If other people like it, then that's a bonus, but I'm not really making it for them. I'm making it for me.
Yeah, I see your question now. So you're asking me then, so obviously the question was, my answer would be yes, because to me, I felt like that was kind of like a really high F, D minus movie. After finishing through it, when I felt like this is a D plus or a C minus movie, and I kind of like it. I mean, I like the work that was done to it, and I was proud of that stuff. Watching it again now, of course, it's kind of like when you go back and look at your yearbook photos and you'd be like, why did I wear that? And it's just out there forever, that sort of thing.
And you have the giant perm and
and you can just sort of giggle, oh, I would do something different there. I could have fixed that. You know, now we have equipment that we could have done that, but I don't want to go down that path.
Why constantly relive the past when you've used what you learned in the past to move yourself forward?
Yeah, that's it.
Well, all that said, I will say that now when I think of The Phantom Menace, I won't think of it quite the same way, and which I think is a good thing. I mean, because I really detested the movie. I was, you know, when I saw it, I went to the theater and I saw it, and I was just so let down. But, and you know, and it's had a certain taste in my mouth about it ever since. But after watching your edit, you know, it's different. I have a different feel on it. So now I have to watch the second one.
I agree with that, in that now, since it's been such a time span in between doing that, when I watch it, I always, I'll watch the Phantom edit, and I'll think that, gosh, I was just being harsh on this movie. I mean, this isn't so terrible. And then I'll go and I'll pop in the real one, and then it'll all come back again. And I'll be like, oh, wow, it really, wow. So it's different in that sense, where I still feel, you know, you ask me if I like it. And if that's the case, then yes.
So, Mike, thanks again for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. I mean, it's been a hell of a lot of fun.
No, thank you. This is a lot of fun. Thank you.
And maybe we can have you back.
That's great. Thank you. You know how to find me?
Well, I know how to find you, but where can the listeners find you?
Well, mostly through Twitter, at The Edit Doctor. And if you go to theeditdoctor.com, that goes to that blog, the Tumblr blog that you found. And that pretty much encompasses it.
And Maggie, where can we find you?
Oh, you can find me on the Twitters as well, at TANKGRRL. Or at about.me/Maggie McPhee. And sir, where can we find you?
You can find me on the Twitters as at Octothorpe, OCTOTHORPE. You can also find me at localtype.org. And of course, you can always find me at ruiningitforeveryone.tv. That was another episode of Ruining It For Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It For Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out. We've been chatting with Mike J. Nichols, the Edit Doctor and the creator of the Phantom Edit.
You've been listening to the smooth jazz sounds.